Before we do that, I'd just like to announce that following the AGM of the Terrans, we now have a new chairman, Chris O'Connell, and I'd like to introduce you to Chris, who will now take over the chair for the rest of the day. Okay, thanks, Viv. Don't go too far away, because what we'd like to give you is just a quick token. In public of thanks for the work that you've put in on the board this year and that you'll be continuing to do on the board at least for next year. So I just like everyone to publicly thank me. Terrans has been through a fairly momentous couple of years, and the financial results, everything we've just seen at the AGM actually shows that you've got an organisation that's in good health. We've got an exciting new board. We've had a great old board, and it's in a large part down to Mav's efforts. Okay, we've got a little bit of time to catch up, Southman. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce this afternoon's speaker, the Honourable Bill Inglis, Deputy Leader of the National Party and the Spokesperson for Finance. As I think everyone in this room is aware, the National Party has announced a bold vision for how it would like to see some of the infrastructure issues tackled. I'm not going to say any more than that other than to give the floor to Mr. Inglis and get everyone to save up any pithy questions that we've got for the end, because I'm sure there'll be a few. Shane, one of our speakers this morning, seemed to have quite a few questions, but he's gone. So with no further ado, the Right Honourable Bill Inglis. Mr. Chairman, recently appointed, I gather about an hour ago. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for the first opportunity I've had to talk to Terrans. It's not my intention to make any new announcements today, but I do want to put the announcement about broadband that we made in some context, talk about some of the ways that we would expect to be approaching it if we become the government. A couple of weeks ago, John Key outlined our intention to see New Zealand achieve fibre to the home. There's been a great deal of thinking and internal advocacy and behind that, including from a spokesman who you're familiar with, Maurice Williamson. There's a couple of, I just want to give a couple of examples of why we've moved, I suppose, across the line to some enthusiasm for this, and I will be expressing my views in layman's terms. I'm not a network engineer. I'm a user of technology. I like it to do what I want it to do and do it better than Microsoft Windows ever used to. One is simply opening up the possibility of services that we can't expect. What do I mean by that? I like the story about how texting turned up. I'm a texter. It's the main way I communicate with my six children when they're not at home. It's made our life much more manageable because we know what time to pick them up for practice or where they've got to or what they're doing at 2 o'clock in the morning. But it wasn't a service anyone expected out of mobile telephony. It was started by started being used by, as I understand it, groups of Japanese teenagers. And I expect that as we move forward, while people like me express some skepticism about the depth of consumer demand for services that will use the capacity of fibre to the home, on the one hand. On the other hand, I expect that the biggest benefits will be in ways that we don't anticipate right now. And that is part of the excitement of the technology and any investment in it. The second point I want to make is a phenomenon that I think is going to be a powerful driver of everything from government policy to social interaction. It seems to me by far the most significant aspect of the network is the way that it creates the ability for what I call self-aggregation. We haven't had this before. That is the ability of people across the whole globe to, at no cost, find other people they want to connect with and do so free of regulation, free of government policy, free of institutional constraints. And we've seen that in some obvious ways through the success of ideas like Facebook, but I expect or trained me in the way as a self-aggregation system. But I expect there's many ways we don't anticipate which will turn out to be quite important. It's something no one can control. Which is the sheer beauty of it. So there's just a couple of things that are part of the thinking behind our enthusiasm for getting on with this new technology. I just want to outline a bit to you our broad plan for the economy. When I looked at Internet New Zealand's manifesto, they have targeted broader economic issues as the context for the adoption of fibre. We believe it is vital for New Zealand to step up its economic performance. Right now, that performance is hitting the wall, but in the longer term, the 5 to 10 year horizon, will come out of the current downturn. And it will be an opportunity to make us competitive again with places like Australia. And we have set out and will continue to do so in the run up to the election a range of steps we intend to take: lower taxes, disciplined government spending, less bureaucracy and regulation, national standards in education, and effective investment in infrastructure. And I just want to focus a bit on infrastructure so you can understand the way our way of thinking and the context in which any participation by government in fibre to the home will occur. There's political agreement, I think, across the spectrum that New Zealand needs to invest in infrastructure. We had a surplus of it back in the 70s and 80s, through the restructuring in the 90s. We used up a lot of that surplus capacity as we should have because we were over-invested. But now, 10 years of pretty solid economic growth means that we are hitting the limits again, whether it's the electricity transmission system, sewage, or telecommunications. However, wanting to do it is only one step. It's going to be vital over the next decade that we do it effectively. And at the moment, the investment is not done effectively. In fact, government doesn't really think of an investment as investment. Currently, our infrastructure is cash funded. So we build what we can out of what cash we've got left over after we do everything else. No one else does it. No business does it like that. Certainly they use cash some of the time. But if we only built the houses we could out of cash, we'd all be living in hovels. And actually other governments aren't doing that. We are almost alone in the developed and in fact in the semi-developed world in being entirely reliant on taxpayers' cash for our infrastructure investment. In the international context, it's weird. And we are going to change that because infrastructure is about long-term investment, so we should be using longer-term methods of financing it, not just cash. That will help a lot with changing the incentives, particularly for public investment, so that bureaucrats don't do what they do now, which is not do things because it enables them to hoard cash and therefore have more flexibility and more choices. It also means that government doesn't pay enough attention to the regulatory environment because when it's investing, it's not thinking long term. When it starts thinking as a long term investor, it will change the way it thinks about its regulatory role. Over the next 10 years, we estimate there's something like 60 to 70 billion of just public investment between central and local government. That's not counting any private investment. So if we can do that 10% better, we will pay for a fiber network 3 times over with the spare cash. So we will be focusing very much on transforming the environment and the rules around public investment. There'll be a lot of benefits from that. And I think a real opportunity in the next few years with the credit crunch, while, for instance, telcos are going to have all sorts of trouble trying to raise money to do anything, as are any other corporates, the market will be very keen to fund things that government wants to do because government can pay back. So the credit crunch means there'll be a lot of willing participants in public-private partnerships. There is also a mature market now between the UK and Australia and many other jurisdictions. Plenty of people now know a lot more about how the government can get the benefits of public-private partnerships, better risk management, better efficiency of spending. There's also, with the growth of KiwiSaver and other sovereign funds around the world, the need for long-dated assets for them to invest in. So we would hope that by taking a long-term investment approach to infrastructure, we're able to create some products for the public investment market, where funds who are looking for something that's going to pay back over 20 or 30 years will actually be able to buy it. I mean, if you're in New Zealand now, what the hell do you buy? Don't buy Auckland Airport. We just slashed its share price by a third and you have no idea what the rules will be. It's basically unsaleable to anyone now. It's been a bit risky buying telecom. Their share price is halved the last 4 or 5 years. We don't have much in the way. In fact, almost nothing in the way of long-term blue-chip investment. So we would hope to help create some of that product. So that's the context in which we are going to be approaching broadband. It's simply one factor, one plank in a pretty broad approach to infrastructure. And in fact, in that context, one of the cheaper ones, for all its other challenges, it's not actually near as expensive as, for instance, finishing the motorway network in Auckland. In fact, the cost of putting a tunnel under the Prime Minister's favourite park exceeds by 20% our commitment to investment in the hot fibre network for the whole country. So if we think the numbers are big, There's plenty of other numbers that are much bigger. In John's speech, we outline some of the principles that we want to apply. And I'd have to say the next week, while given that there's some possibility we'll become the government, we want to refine the principles. I just want to take you through those because many people haven't looked at them. The first thing we want to make sure is that any government contribution leads to measurable increases in service. We're not willing to see the money stick to the sides of the ducts. We want measurable benefits to flow through to consumers. So the investment or the subsidy, however it turns out that we're looking at, is not there for the providers of infrastructure or services. It's there to benefit the consumers in the end. Secondly, we don't want to crowd out private investment. We are a private sector party. We don't believe in the current government's mission to buy up everything in New Zealand. We think private investment does a better job, and there's a very long track record that proves that. Thirdly, we're not going to go about this in a way that gives any undue advantage or windfall for incumbents. And I mean small as well as large incumbents in the market. And finally, we want to make damn sure that even with public participation, the sector itself remains dynamic and innovative. The real risk of public investment or subsidy in any sector is that it can dampen the dynamism, the competitiveness, and the innovation. And some of our sectors, like public transport, have just been such boring industries for so long because they've been funded by someone who doesn't really care whether it works for people or not. They just like public transport. And public transport may well be a good thing, but I'm sure we could have done a much better job of it. Nor do we want to crown investment to lock in or lock out particular technologies. I mean, fibre is the technology, but there's going to be any amount of other technology that goes round it. We don't want to knock that out, and nor do we want to take all the risk out of it. Because it is risk, as you all know, that drives the dynamism and the innovation in telecommunications. So please don't expect the Crown to sign up to making it a one-way bet for everybody who is in the industry. That is not what we're going to do. We don't underestimate the complexities of becoming involved. The public-private interaction will be complex. One has only got to look at the array of fiber networks that are already in place to understand how complicated it could be to execute the vision that we've talked about. In fact, it consistently surprises me. The other day I was on the top of Queenstown Hill. Queenstown has come into my electorate. And there's some very well-graded roads up there. This is on the hill above the trees behind the town. And I asked one of the locals why the roads were so well graded, and they explained to me it's because Telstra Clear have laid a fibre right through the backcountry from Queenstown to Wanaka. I had absolutely no idea. But it's a lot cheaper to put it through there than to put it along the road. What I want to do now is just talk about some lessons from the past, both in telecommunications, but also in other industries where the Crown has participated. One of the key issues for any fibre network is the same as it is for any copper network, and that is regulation. What I think we've learned in the last few years is that it's very difficult when things are changing fast for regulation to keep up with technology. As simple as the way in which the local loop unbundling debate seems to have been compromised somewhat by telecoms cabinetisation proposals. Wasn't possible before the most recent technologies, now it is possible. The regulator is always going to be playing catch-up, and I think we have to be a bit careful about understanding the vital role regulation plays, but also understanding its limitations. The second is that this is a risky business, and while the risks are high, there are not in fact a queue of investors waiting to plough millions of risk capital into it. And if I can give the industry one bit of advice, I think the expectations around unbundling were raised too high and left the public somewhat disappointed. So we've got to be careful not to raise And the expectation was that people would crowd in with hundreds of millions of investment. We'd all have vastly better services. Of course, it's turned out to be a great deal more complex than that. Not that it was a mistake or anything, but these things take time. They are difficult, and many of them are line ball calls about what's going to be better and what's not. If the answers were easy, they would have been put in place years ago, because I can tell you politicians just love easy answers. Thirdly, the government is not going to ignore risk and return. If it's in there, either as an investor or a subsidizer, we do not want to go down the track that the current government wants to go down with railways. And isn't that a contrast? In the last month, we've announced commitment to a fibre network and they've brought back the railways. And they're in the process of transforming it into where a situation where the government's going to take all the risk on what is a very difficult business, it will become a big black hole that sucks in endless amounts of taxpayers' money. I can tell you that if we are participating in any investment, we'll be looking at the risk and looking at some kind of ultimate return. It is certainly part of our commitment that government will be subsidising this network. We want to de-risk the early investment and getting a complete network, and the Crown will take losses on that one way or another. But that is not going to be a permanent state. The fourth thing is that capital is rationed even when it's the Crown. Even when it's the Crown. So the government has made its own choices, decided not to fix the problems with having not enough schools in Queenstown and spend the money buying back the railways. We are bound by what is now at least $1 billion commitment by the current government if we become the government, which means there's $1 billion less easy to find to put into fibre. So capital is rationed, the government does not have an endless supply of it and will be pretty careful about it. Crown investment does not change the fundamental economics of this business. Thus, fundamental economics, the problems of how you make your money out of high capital investment with low variable costs, is just a sign whether the crown is there or not, and we will want to make sure that the fundamental economics are what are driving our decisions, not just day-to-day political pressures. In the long run, that's what you need. If government doesn't pay attention to getting a return, to getting the fundamental economics right, you will end up with what happens with every other public service, and that's bad service. The real risk in public participation is that government can dampen the drive to providing the consumer with the service and the experience that they're after. We want to minimize that risk as much as possible. We're also going to be interested in real solutions. While telecom communications has been a highly politicized area in recent years, I think the public interest and tolerance for that has now come to an end. And they are looking for real solutions and better services, not public relations campaigns. Finally, if government goes into this, we are going to be looking to expect consumers to pay for the value that they get. We hear a great deal from the industry and from some outside institutions like the New Zealand Institute that are quite optimistic. Very optimistic, in fact, about the economic impact of having fibre to the home. And I hope they're right. And I suspect that if that kind of value can be created, people will be willing pay for it. So we'll be looking for a correlation between the two. If consumers aren't willing to pay, that tells us something about the value that's being created. Maybe it's not sufficient. Maybe we need to change the mix again. We don't want government to dampen those signals. So can I just make a couple of final points? We have set ourselves a very challenging target, and that is to get fibre to the home sometime over the next 6 to 10 years. Some people say it's unreasonable. I might have been of that view myself for a while. Some people say that we've grossly oversimplified it. There's any number of objections. Did we talk to Telecom about it? Is there the money to do this sort of thing? Do people want to use it? Well, all I can say is that those challenges arise only in proportion to the scope of the vision. And there is no doubt that what we are aiming to achieve would be fantastic if we achieved it. We don't pretend there aren't challenges, but we do, we have made it clear, and John Key has particularly made it clear about our commitment to dealing with all those challenges. Just because there will be complexities and politics around it doesn't mean that we are going to be put off at all. So this will be a test, if we become the government, a test of our collective capacity to let our imagination about a better future take us over the many obstacles that will no doubt be thrown up in our way. And in that sense, if we're the government, we will certainly be looking for goodwill and a sharing of that sense of enthusiasm from the industry. While there are a range of interests and plenty of potential for the usual gossip, knocking, and chipping away at the other players, it's not our intention as a government to take part in that kind of process. We'll be looking for real solutions and a commitment to what I believe is going to become a national vision for the country, not just a national vision for our party. Thanks very much. Thank you, that actually brings us back on schedule, so that room for a couple of pithy questions. Has anyone got any questions for me? Just a question from a layman in terms of the financial side of this. If you're looking at 1.4 billion expenditure, does the National Party propose means that the government actually takes an ownership stake in the investment, or what form of equity would it actually take? I'm just not clear on how that would work. Well, we're probably not going to get into a whole lot of detail about that, particularly over the next few months. Partly because we don't have the internal capacity to do the analysis that's required to get us to the best solution. Certainly the kind of Fiberco model and the Oak has been fairly dominant in our thinking as it has in the sector, because there's some critical things that everyone's after, like open access, for instance. There's also other ways of approaching it through the subsidy. In fact, if you want an example of both, probably one of the last large projects that where government took this kind of approach was over Maui Gas. And if you have a look at that, they took an equity stake to de-risk the front-end investment, and then they wrote a contract which was slightly unfortunate, but it was a take-or-pay contract that ensured some cash flow. And I see Mr. Friedlander in the audience, he'll know this stuff inside out, because he would have been involved in it. So we're going back to have a look at just how all that was put together. There's a range of tools, and we want to make sure we have a good look at them. Fiberco is sort of the one that's there, the most obvious one at the moment, and the easiest way to express the investment, I suppose. But there are others, and we would hope that the industry is going to spend a fair bit of time on it. I'm also conscious of the fact that a government gets to put so much effort in. It's got a whole lot of things to do. And even with an infrastructure, this is just one part of what is going to be a pretty broad infrastructure program. It may be that it's a hell of a lot of effort to try and get in both ends, governance and ownership and demand subsidy. And we may end up having to pick one. And just because, you can imagine the complexities in trying to get both of those things right, as well as be the regulator of it. Unless you've got a sort of three-cornered government participation. possibilities of making mistakes, and that kind of complexity are very high. Very keen to listen to the industry about it. You know, we haven't got some secret option locked away in the cupboard. The way we've gone about our thinking so far is to be to consult pretty widely. Just before the announcement, advised Telecom about our plans, but didn't make any changes to it. Because of anything they said. So we're keen to hear from the industry. You know, there's a market out there. If it's got some solutions, present them to us. Okay. Sorry to sound like a broken record. What would National's perspective or policy be on the behaviour part of telecommunications? We've spoken a lot today about infrastructure, new networks being built, new initiatives on the infrastructure side. What about some of the old rules that didn't serve us well in the 90s? I'm thinking of abuse of significant market power and Commerce Act protocols. Well, there's always regulatory issues. You have to regulate this business. Whatever arguments you had, there's always trade-offs. I think we should remember that. It's from a public point of view, from a participant's point of view, it's pretty obvious what the government should do. For instance, unbundling, in my view, has led inevitably to public investment. Because the change of regulation just means it's too hard for someone to take all the investment risk and consumer risk, so they don't do it. So the $1.5 billion is, the taxpayer fronting up, because we wanted unbundling. And now to get the investment for the next technology, we're going to have to do it. If we want it sooner. With regulation, I don't care about whatever the arguments were. I think there's a lot of rhetoric, and I'd hope that everyone can kind of move on both sides of those arguments. There is a real challenge ahead of us to work out how to get the rules right to ensure that you end up with competitive service for consumers. That's what we're after. competitive service to consumers and sustainability. Okay, because some of the providers I've talked to think that the answer to this is for the government to own the network and expect no return on it so everyone can offer cheap services. Well, we ain't gonna do that, and you'll end up with a pretty poor network if you have an owner that doesn't understand depreciation and reinvestment and doesn't feel the competitive pressure to upgrade the technology. So anyone who thinks you're gonna get a cheap government network out of this, well, you're wrong. As to be competitive and dynamic, there's got to be some investment pressure in there. On the regulatory side, we just have to resolve the issues as they arise. I mean, the basic principle is if anything were involved, it has to be open access. Okay, I just want to thank you for a very enlightening talk, not just your policy in this area, but the whole infrastructure trust. I think we'll all be fascinated to see what else comes under those programs. And I take from this a strong challenge to us as users to actually clearly articulate our wants, desires, needs and responsibilities, because the days of a large monopoly utility simply rolling out the services as they get invented are over. And with the power that the user has also comes responsibility, so be sure that if you find yourself implementing this policy, that TURANS will be very keen to engage in terms of shaping and structuring the details. So once again, thank you.